I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Here's what Bill O'Reilly, host of The O'Reilly Factor on Fox, said a few years ago. He said, if a producer can find someone who eggs on conservative listeners to spout off and prods liberals into shouting back, he's got a show. The best host is the guy or gal who can get the most listeners extremely annoyed over and over and over again. Well, it's worked for O'Reilly, the host of the most popular program on cable news. Our guest, Diana Mutz, looked at shows like The Factor and Chris Matthews' Hardball on MSNBC when researching her new book. It's called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. She found that viewers do get riled up when watching heated political fights on TV, especially when the camera closes in on the conflict. She says there are pros and cons for this kind of coverage, and that's what we're talking about in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Diana Mutz is the Samuel A. Stauffer Professor of Political Science and Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics. Diana Mutz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
I do want to play a montage of cable news pundits just to get everyone in the mood.
But you still haven't answered my question.
Refuses,
here's the
you
problem.
Won't allow me to speak.
I am
Sean,
allowing you to
I'm
speak.
I'm here to give you
listen, Congressman,
a fair
you're a very intelligent
view.
Guy. Had are you capable of answering a simple question?
No, no, I think it's not shameful to say you are bragging about the fact that we weren't hit after 9/11.
And
that's
we should
right.
All you're be proud that we haven't been.
You're bragging about
11th.
The fact we weren't
that's
hit.
That's exactly right.
How can you
that's
brag about?
Going to remember.
Because you're lying.
I'm not lying.
You are lying.
Don't call me a liar. Don't you sit there and call
no,
me a liar.
No, you're lying.
I'm not lying.
Hey,
you
here's
just,
the
you
proof.
Don't, you don't like the
here's
president.
The proof.
You don't like what he's doing.
Give me.
But don't sit there and call me a liar.
I am.
No, no.
Totally
different. It's an inapt analogy. It's an inapt analogy.
There are Republican governors that have expanded Medicaid.
And they are getting killed.
Please.
Wait a second. Do you like that? Do you
spare me,
Jennifer?
Spare me that this is a Democrat Republican.
No, no, tell
okay,
me.
So,
though.
Number one, it's
no,
not.
No, I want to hear
number
what you
two,
say.
Let me
I
finish
hear,
your question.
Jennifer, I want to hear
two,
what you believe. Do you believe in Medicaid expansion?
Right,
these
and I think that the misreading of that
also raised the issue of redistribution of wealth.
To,
that
I
is,
think,
you can try to talk
myth
over
myth
me,
McCain,
but I'm
no,
not going to stop.
I think what you're
what can I say? So assaultive. Obviously, when edited together, Diana, it does sort of increase the intensity of the interaction. And there are moments in even the most sort of fight fest of these cable pundit shows where there is some calm discussion. What's the attraction, do you think?
The attraction is that it isn't something that happens to us in our day-to-day lives much. Most of the time, we're pretty polite with one another. And on these kinds of shout shows, when people talk over one another and yell and scream and so forth, it's very, you know, physiologically arousing to listen to. It's exciting, like watching a prize fight is. And I think that's why it really grabs our attention, despite the fact we don't like it.
Well, which is interesting. So right. We are aroused. And one, even listening to that, I could feel myself getting kind of fired up. We're aroused, but we say we don't like it.
Right. I think we know that it violates our norms for face-to-face discourse. And as a result, we recognize it as something disagreeable. On the other hand, we're pretty much hardwired to pay attention to conflict. It's really important to notice conflict in your environment for, you know, the sake of your evolutionary well-being. And I think that's what happens when we hear a fight break out or we hear people raise their voices, then we do pay attention. And that's really what the producers of these shows are capitalizing on.
You begin your book with, actually goes back to 2003, President George W. Bush is on television. He's telling the American people about the start of the Iraq War. Your mother-in-law walks into the room. What's her reaction?
She said, I'm feeling physically ill. I'm sick to my stomach. I can't stand having that man in my face. And it struck me at the time that even though she was talking about someone on television who obviously wasn't physically in our home, he was in our faces. It was an extreme close-up shot that filled our entire field of vision in a way that I wouldn't experience unless someone was truly, really, really physically close to me.
And that's something new, this sort of severe close-up shot on these pundit shows?
Well, it's happened gradually over time, partly because technologically it's easier to do than it used to be when cameras were big and heavy and difficult to get that kind of shot. But I think what's happened is, just as film producers realize that if you want emotional intensity in a particular shot, you go in for a close-up. The same thing is true on political television. And political television doesn't have a, you know, great plot line like a drama does on television. So they'll do anything they can to really improve on the level of attention and intensity. We like emotional intensity and we pay attention to it. It's just something that we're not, until relatively recently in our history, accustomed to in the political realm.
You have two pictures side by side. It's either Huntley or Brinkley. At this age, I kind of forget which one was which. Next to, I think it's Brian Williams. So we're going back to the 60s and then a couple of years ago. And the camera shot on Brian Williams is sort of from his neck up on either the Huntley or the Brinkley. You can even see some of his desk.
That's right. And it's as if they are physically actually closer to us as viewers. They fill a larger portion of our visual field and of the TV screen. And in addition to that, our TVs are much bigger these days. So it really feels like they're in our faces and much closer to us than they used to be.
And as you say, it sort of violates, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, the kind of physical space that we have when we're talking to people in our actual analog lives.
Right. In our face-to-face interpersonal lives, it's true there are cultural differences in how close is deemed appropriate, but in all cultures, when there's conflict, when you disagree with a person, even without thinking about it, you back off physically. You step back. You put greater physical distance between yourself and the person with whom you disagree. On TV, that's not what happens, though. In fact, you know, sometimes they're artificially juxtaposed right next to one another in the little boxed heads kind of format that's so common these days. So even though they might be on one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, it looks like they're screaming at each other right next to each other. And that violates a really important social norm. And that social norm is meant to diffuse the emotional intensity of the conflict. If you're having an argument with someone and they come closer to you, that's not good.
You feel threatened.
You feel threatened, and rightly so. So basically, we're using our brains are interpreting it as if it were face to face, even though we know on television this is pretty common.
But is this by design? Is this? I mean, I quoted O'Reilly, who you quote in your book. Is this producers who say, "Aha! You know, the way to get people to listen and pay attention is to have a lot of fighting and a lot of close-ups."
I think it has evolved over time, in part in response to the level of competition for our attention in media. We have so much more choice than we used to have. And as a result, the producers of political content really work hard to get our attention. And, you know, from my perspective, that's a good thing. We Sure. want people to pay attention Sure. to political television and to learn things and so forth. The problem is this has become the main way that we draw people's attention. That is, using incivility, because we know not only does it draw people's immediate attention, it also makes them more likely to relay it to their friends and talk about it and so forth. So politicians will purposely have events like that, even though it violates social norms and we say we don't like it. Nonetheless, people will hear about it. You can guarantee that it'll be diffused more widely.
And people, are they more likely to remember what it is that they heard, either the thing that they agree with or disagree with, if it's shouted at them?
Yes. If arousal levels are high and people are responding to, you know, in-your-face kinds of political portrayals, they remember more. They pay more attention, and they also enjoy viewing more, which means they're going to be, you know, drawn toward watching more of that kind of content. Those are all good things Sure. from my perspective. But there are negative consequences as well, and I highlight those in my book. One of them is that the public's level of trust in politicians goes way down. And partly, I think that's a result of the fact that we look at these people screaming and yelling at each other on the screen and we think, these aren't normal people. These aren't like my friends and neighbors. Why are these people outside the bounds of normal human behavior? And I think that's why we think they're not to be trusted. The other, I think, for these days, even more central consequence to be concerned about is that it increases the intensity of our dislike for whoever it is we already dislike. So we may see two politicians or a politician and a journalist go at it, and we agree with one of them. And it doesn't really change our mind that they're acting uncivil. But what does happen is that the person that we thought wasn't right, we now think they're evil, not just wrong, not just mistaken, but truly motivated by awful things. And I think that's part of the reason politicians have so much trouble governing these days, is that there's no longer such a thing as a respectful opposition. It's, you know, you're right or you're wrong, you're good or you're bad.
So here we are having a civil conversation about, I guess, uncivil conversations. Is this conversation that we're having, is this boring to listeners or to viewers?
Depends on the listeners. One of the things about political television is that there's more of it these days, and people who are political junkies just eat it up. I'm sure they're listening.
And saying, rolling their eyes.
Yeah. Right. No, they're going to watch it regardless of what it's like, because they find politics inherently interesting. The problem is we don't want just people who are political junkies involved in the political process. We want people, you know, who are only moderately interested, but who pick up information, you know, in the course of their day-to-day lives. And so if you're a person who doesn't, you know, get up first thing in the morning thinking about politics, and I'll tell you, I'm not one of those people myself, even though I do study it, they're not going to tune in to something that's boring and dull. They're not going to talk to their friends about something that's boring and dull and civil either.
Can you say it's partisan in any way? I mean, can you say that conservatives versus liberals are more attracted to conflict or not?
What's interesting in my experiments is that I find, first of all, using incivility is not partisan in the sense that you find it in both conservative and liberal-leaning programs. It may have been conservatives who really innovated it and started it, but it's out there regardless of the political leaning of the program. But conservatives do appear to be particularly drawn to it, and they respond especially strongly to it. That is, I had the sense, if I were to guess, that they might like it better or be more drawn to it, but that they were used to it or accustomed to it, and they weren't going to react as strongly. That's not the case, and I think it highlights how this isn't so much a conscious process; it's just a gut level response that we have. And conservatives do tend to respond very strongly. It results in even bigger effects on their levels of trust in government and politicians. And in some ways, that fits with, in general, conservatives' dislike of government and distrust of government involvement in all types of our affairs.
I do want to pick up on that, but first we're going to take a very short break. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, when we look at, I guess, all things political, and talking with Diana Mutz. She's a professor of political science and communication at the University of Pennsylvania, also serves as director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics. And we're talking about her new book. It's called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. We began our conversation with a montage of cable news pundits really going at each other. We're going to take a very short break. Give us a comment at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Diana Mutz. And again, she's got a new book. It's called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. And if you watch cable news, you know it can get pretty heated. There's generally a lot of shouting and screaming, mockery. Do these loud debates and ugly arguments affect the way that Americans think about politics and candidates, elections, government? And issues. And our guest, Diana Mutz, believes that they do. And that's what we're talking about on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have an email from Marge. She says, I had to walk away from Morning Joe. Good topics and interesting guests, but everyone talking at once and over each other was so annoying that I stopped watching. So I guess sometimes the strategy backfires.
You know, it's interesting because we asked the people in our studies whether they found it annoying and so forth, and they did too. But what was odd is that they still were more likely to want to watch those programs again or to talk about it. And you know, I think it's a common thing to think that what we like is what we go for, what we want. I like to think of it as kind of like rubbernecking on the highway. It's not that we want there to be dead bodies by the side of the road. That's not why we look, because we hope to see something gory. But we are kind of hardwired to look because it's important information. And I think that distinction is hard because absolutely everyone will tell you they hate this stuff. You know, it drives them away from politics and so forth. And I think they're telling us the truth, but I also think it's really hard not to pay attention.
Also, I would think that, you know, for those political junkies, I mean, it's hard to turn this stuff off. I mean, as you say, these are the people that wake up in the morning saying, you know, I wonder what Bernie Sanders is doing today, or, you know, Rand Paul, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, certain people, regardless of the format, are going to pay attention, but there are a lot of people, you know, they're busy, they have their lives, and really politics only catches their attention when something extraordinary happens or when somebody screams "you lie" at the president or, you know, that kind of thing. So these types of events get talked about, people replay them on the media over and over, and so as a result, it's what people remember and what they take away.
We have a Facebook comment from Susan. She says, I'm enjoying the conversation. I like calm discussion. However, I will tune in a Rush Limbaugh type once in the blue just to keep my ear and eye on the enemy, as she describes it. I mean, we do live in very partisan times.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a change during my lifetime toward more partisan media in this country. It's important to remember, I think we have had partisan media in this country in the past, so it's not entirely new. It's just new to us, I think. It's a different type of format than we were socialized to expect from media. It's very partisan. You can watch the oppositional viewpoints and become more polarized, become even more strongly opposed to the opposition. Ideally, we would like it to be in a format where what you come away with is some sort of understanding of why the opposition holds the views they do. Mm. That's what's ideal for purposes of compromise, moderation, and so forth. And one of the things that we document in the experiments is that people who see the in-your-face versions of the very same political program will come away with much stronger hatred for the opposition. And I think that's a problem because in any election, you know, about half the time, our guy loses or our gal loses. And as a result, we don't always get what we want. And yet we agree to be governed by these people. So there has to be some degree of respect for the opposition.
Do you think there's a show that does what you think they could do, should do?
I wouldn't say I think that's what they should do. I mean, it's actually kind of funny. When I first started this research project, I wasn't going to produce my own highly controlled content. I was going to take off-air content from civil and uncivil programs. Well, all the highly civil programs went off the air. They just didn't, you know, grab large enough audiences to survive. And I think that's, you know, part of what the problem is. We realize that only a certain number of programs are going to have enough viewers to survive and so forth. If all these programs looked highly civil and like some ideal model of political debate out of some textbook somewhere, I don't think that would be ideal because I think people would watch, you know, Showtime or go to Netflix or, you know, we have so much choice these days that we're not by default going to tune into these things. So how do we get those people who are not all that interested in politics to pay attention? I think we need another means of drawing their attention. Incivility has obvious negative consequences, so I'm not advocating that as the best way to draw public attention. Nonetheless, I don't think we want to just say, oh, we don't really care if anybody watches.
I was thinking of the British Parliament. I mean, we often use that as an example. I mean, it's, at least to an American or outsider, it seems like these are high-minded arguments where people call each other out.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a different kind of tone to it.
Well, I think it's rule governed. And it does have not only a set of formal rules for debate, but also when you watch it unfold, although it can be tense and it can be nasty and so forth. And I think that kind of tension does attract viewers. You know that a fight is not about to break out. And I do think that's something that Americans often forget is although we'd like to claim that, oh, this is the most uncivil time we've ever had and so forth, That's probably not true. Politicians have always said horrible things about one another. I think the main difference these days is that we have a front row seat as members of the public, and we see and hear and view far more of this uncivil content than we ever did in the past.
It seems, excuse me, also, if you look at, for instance, let's say an MSNBC, excuse me, and a Fox, is that Fox seems to have, you know, a largely conservative audience.
Mm-hmm.
MSNBC probably has a more liberal audience.
Correct.
So we end up having kind of segregated viewing. So you view people who confirm the things that you already believe in, and they confirm it in a, you know, in a probably loud and combative kind of way.
I think that's true, although in order to have the kind of conflict that makes things lively, they usually have some sort of foil, someone to disagree with on those programs. And so they may choose those strategically. But what patterns of viewing show is that people who are into politics, they actually watch more of what they agree with, but they also watch what they disagree with. As your caller said, to do things like figure out, you know, keep an eye on the enemy, that kind of thing. So it's more the gap is between the political haves and have-nots, the people who are just not that interested in a presidential election year like this one. They will get drawn into the process. That's why we have so much higher turnout during a presidential election year. Nonetheless, to get information to those people, you have to do something other than, you know, have a PBS-style civil debate.
Is that what – I mean, is it the PBS-type civil debate? Is that the sort of, you know, yawn,
well,
eye roll?
It can be. It can be. It's not always. I mean, these things are not always – perfectly pre-scripted and so forth, but certainly the candidates want them to be predictable. They want to their staffs want them to be controlled, and so there's a lot of negotiation over those characteristics. The more controlled, staged, and so forth it is, yeah, the more boring it is. It's nothing too exciting.
True that. You include actually a really interesting comment. This is about Nightline when Ted Koppel was the host. And the person unnamed here says that he would generally put his guests into a different studio and they couldn't even see him. I guess mm-hmm. they could hear him, but they couldn't see him. And this person says, by removing his person from you, Koppel cunningly deprives you of your animal instinct, of the will you could muster in an eye-to-eye, mano-a-mano exchange. So obviously by design, and it allowed Ted Koppel to kind of I guess, be the true boss of the conversation.
Right. I think he maintained an upper hand. And in fact, many politicians who said they'd come on his show only if they could appear in the same studio at the same table with him, he refused.
Yeah.
And he sent people next door to pop onto the screen from a different studio. And I think that has a number of advantages for you as a journalist who wants to be hard-hitting and so forth. And part of it is that we're very well-socialized, to be civil to one another. And you come across as mean and nasty when you are highly uncivil to someone in a close face-to-face situation. It's a lot easier to do that when they're in another room, they're just on a screen somewhere, and they're not a flesh-and-blood human being in your immediate environment. And I think that's why Koppel did it. If for people who've ever appeared on one of these shows, when you're looking at a blank screen, you can hear but not see who you're
yes.
talking to. It's very artificial. It's very odd. You don't have the benefit of reading their facial expressions. You don't it's a situation where it's really easy to misunderstand one another. But, you know, if you want to make it lively and exciting, that's perfectly fine. You want that kind of tension. And it's not that we don't have that tension when we're in face-to-face situations. We do. We all know arguments are tense and
absolutely.
Uncomfortable. And they cause our levels of arousal to go up, too, in our real lives. But the fact is, when we do it in a highly artificial way that violates all of our face-to-face rules, we respond even more strongly to it.
And that's Diana Mutz, our guest in this edition of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. We've been talking a lot about the cable news shows where there is a fair amount of yelling and screaming going on, and talking about some of the questions it raises about our level of discourse, our kind of discourse, and our politics as well. We have a bunch of tweets here. Tweet from Michael: the increase in external stimulation, cell phones, internet, etc., make a made necessary program that pushes our senses. And you talk a bit about the internet in here as well.
Yes, exactly. If you look at the kind of things that get attention, it's extreme, nasty comments, and certainly being able to post anonymously encourages that kind of thing. So I think, you know, he's absolutely right that when you have so much competition for our very limited attention span, you have to go to extremes to get people to pay attention. And the question is whether there are better ways to do it other than screaming and yelling and turning up the volume and so forth. But it's a problem. Our attention is really frazzled these days.
And we have a tweet from Matthew says, people don't mind yelling. They know it's political theater. More people get it's a two-party farce. I mean, I guess a kind of cynicism that it can lead to as well.
It is political theater, but I think that's what it's always been. That is, it was political theater, you know, back in the days of Jefferson and Adams and so forth. It was very much for the benefit of the audience. I don't think that in and itself is necessarily bad. Politicians need to communicate with the public. You know, if they do that in a theatrical manner in order to get us to pay attention, so much the better. I don't have a problem with that. But it's when we use a gimmick like incivility to draw more attention and to get the message diffused further along that we have problems, because this does make us think less of them all at the same time. It doesn't only have the effect of drawing our attention.
Do you think it's different if someone is incivil, uncivil, and honest, and uncivil and dishonest? Does honest, is that a factor, do you think?
Not too much, because honesty is usually in the eye of the beholder. What we find is that people see the person they disagree with who's uncivil as being a total jerk and outside the bounds of normal civil interaction. When their own person, the person that they agree with, acts that way, it's just righteous indignation and they should be acting that way and so forth. So we have different standards for people we agree with and people we disagree with. So, you know, whether they're honest or not, usually we don't know. And further, we judge them based on our own predispositions.
You have an interesting, I'm not sure exactly if it's a solution at the end, but you talk about reality shows and the kind of competition that goes along with reality shows. And maybe there's something we could learn from that and maybe apply to these kinds of angry discourses.
Right. I felt like the book was kind of depressing in the sense that I had highlighted a problem, but I hadn't really suggested some directions we might take for solutions. And so in my last chapter, I try to come up with some of those ideas. And one of the analogies I like to point to, because I think it very much parallels what we're experiencing with political television, is children's television. And, you know, there was an era when we discovered as researchers that violence really draws kids' attention. Isn't that great? You know, so there was a lot of violence in children's television programming. But we found, for a subset of the population at least, that was very negative influence and facilitated negative effects. So the question is, how do we draw their attention, get kids to watch, but not have these negative effects on them? And what's now called the Sesame Workshop, it was Children's Television Workshop originally, came up with ways that accomplished that. And I think we need a political television workshop that accomplishes the same thing for political television. We do have a lot of good examples out there. We have a lot of reality TV shows that involve competition, that involve input from viewers. People love that. My own kids, you know, were voting for American Idol candidates under the blankets late at night. And people like to participate. And so part of what I suggest are ways to harness the power of competition and citizen involvement to encourage them to pay attention and in ways that have incentives for the politicians as well.
And I'm trying to imagine sort of, you know, taking the, you know, America's Got Talent, or you've included like The Biggest Loser, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and sort of politicizing them. I mean, what would that look like?
Well, you know, other countries have already done some of this, which is what's interesting. Canada has a show which is I may be getting this wrong, the next prime minister, our next great prime minister, they actually, instead of the usual, you know, Randy and Paula type of judges, they have former prime ministers as judges. All of the judges are former prime ministers. So it gives it this kind of gravitas that these are real politicians. Now, what's interesting is this is a reality show that encourages young people to get involved in politics. So it's not the actual candidates in that show. It's young people who have interest in pursuing politics as a career. And, you know, there's a prize. People get to call in and vote and, you know, all the usual kinds of things. And they love it. It's quite popular. The former Jeopardy host, Alex Trebek. Yes, he's the host of the show. So there are other countries that have done this. There are examples in other realms in the United States. For example, I have the greatest admiration for whoever came up with the idea of fantasy football, because it's massively increased viewership of football, because it used to be that we all watched our own home team and that was about it. Now, because we have these fantasy teams that involve players from all sorts of different teams, we have an incentive to watch not only our home team, but all these other football games that are on, and people are watching more and more. So it was a clever idea, and it worked to promote the commercial interests of television, and it also worked to get people more excited about NFL. Now, whether you're an NFL fan or not, you can see
it
that
almost
one
doesn't
way or
matter, but right. As a model.
Right, as a model for how you draw people into the process, how you get them excited and involved.
And we're almost having a break here, but I'm thinking of, you know, just the low voter turnout that we have, whether it's an on-year or off-year election, it's still, you know, sort of shocking when you look at democracies around the world. Mm-hmm. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. A bunch of people leaving us email comments. You can also join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Diana Mutz about her new book. It's called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. And she says perhaps we can learn something from fantasy football or from America's Next Top Model and apply that to our political discourse, our political process. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I'll be reading some emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. And again, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Do you watch political cable TV shows, whether it's Morning Joe or Bill O'Reilly or Rachel Maddow or Chris Matthews, Anderson Cooper? We've been talking about some of these shows with our guest, Diana Mutz. And again, she's a professor of political science and communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's also director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics. And again, the author of a new book called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me read an email from Larry. He says, O'Reilly, et cetera, are only interested in ratings and the money. The hosts have no character. Mark Shields and David Brooks show that debate can be interesting. Although I think Mark Shields, I know that certainly on NPR, it's David Brooks and E.J. Dionne that discuss politics.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're interested in politics, the format is irrelevant. You will be interested regardless. But I don't fault them for wanting audiences, for caring about ratings. You know, we do have a commercial broadcasting system as well as non-commercial. But the fact of the matter is we all want there to be viewers and listeners, because that increases the levels of political information people have, enables them to be better citizens and so forth. So to say they're only interested in ratings, yes, they're interested in ratings. But I want them to have big audiences, too. And so I think the key is to convince them that there are other ways.
And this isn't necessarily in your book, but I'm just curious about sort of how then do you change somebody's mind? As you say, people are pretty passionate about the things that they believe in. It's hard to change someone's mind about their perspective on something political. How does that happen?
Oh, that is a very big question and a huge area of research on political persuasion. You're right, it's not easy, but we do have examples out there right in front of our noses these days. Look at attitudes toward gay marriage and how they've changed nationwide. That's been a relatively fast change. Political scientists are still in the process of trying to understand what drove that change and so forth. But you're right. I mean, if you look at our political process, most people, based on their partisanship that they start out with, they know who they're going to vote for long before we even know who the candidates are. So they are, you know, going to do what they're going to do. There is a small group of people, we usually put that number at about 8%, sometimes less, that are swing voters that will change their minds. And those people can be persuaded, and they're really important people to target because they hold the balance of power and who gets elected and who doesn't.
And are they persuaded because someone is yelling, or are they persuaded because it's a cogent argument, you know, carefully laid out?
Well, it's difficult to make generalizations, but what we find about incivility and in-your-face politics in general is that it's not about persuasion. It intensifies the feelings people already have. And as a result, it does have consequences, but they're not the kind of consequences that would feed into how to make a good political ad to get people to vote for you.
What about The Daily Show, the late, great Colbert Report? How do you see them fitting in? And we'll get to some callers here.
I think they're innovative ways to draw people in who aren't heavily involved in politics or watching news, like young people. Those shows are fun. They're funny. Some have argued that they're not entirely understandable unless you already know something about politics, because you've got to know something to get the joke ultimately. And I think there's some truth to that. But I think that kind of innovation is important. And it's particularly important because younger people look at what politics is all about, both being a politician as well as, you know, participating in the political process. And they think, yuck, why would I want to do that? Those people are nasty. And as a result, they're increasingly being civically involved in ways that are nonpartisan. You know, it's easy to – not easy. I don't want to put it that way. But it's far easier to adopt a cause or a political type of activity that's not a partisan one, whether it be helping the poor or, you know, all kinds of civic involvement that – or even getting out the vote. That's another one. Who can fault you for getting out the vote? You know, it's a nonpartisan activity. But the minute you step into partisan politics, all of this incivility and bitterness comes out. And what we find is many young people say, thanks, but no thanks. I don't want to get involved in that.
And I'm thinking also about John Oliver's show where he's – I mean, he took down FIFA. He took down the Miss America pageant. I mean, he's done, I think, pretty incredible investigations. But just the, I guess maybe the role of humor or sarcasm, you know, the king has no clothes,
right,
you know, the court jester.
Oh, I think it's terrific because it makes people pay attention to this material who wouldn't otherwise. And my favorite one was the one where they did the audio of the Supreme Court argument with the dogs representing each of the Supreme Court justices. It was a riot. It was really funny. But it's also probably the only Supreme Court case that my teenagers know anything about.
There you go.
They can tell you about whether you can put a gun in your beard or whatever. You know, the whole thing brought an issue that otherwise nobody would have heard about to public attention. And humor has the capacity to do that.
Let me get Chris from Ballykinwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Fascinating conversation. Personally, and I'm listening to a lot of this having to do with television, and yet I'm listening to it on the radio, and it made me think about the time when, you know, there were people in the country who would sit to the radio. And
you know what, Chris, I hate to
do
this, but we're missing every other word of your call, and I apologize.
Oh, so sorry.
That's okay. Not your fault. Bad phone line. Let me just look at the computer screen, and hopefully we can digest what you're asking, which is that talking about, I guess, the visual aspect. We're talking about television here. He said, here I am listening to this on the radio, but we're talking about television, the visuals.
Right. And there is a difference. He's absolutely right. What we find in our studies is that the very same conflict between two politicians, same level of intensity and incivility and so forth, when we give people the newspaper transcript of it, as along the lines of what you'd see in the New York Times, And the radio version of it, as if you were just listening, and the TV version of it, they respond far more strongly to the television version. And I think the reason for that is that there are faces, there's inflection, intensity comes through in people's faces. What we find in the radio version is because we have voices, people do sense the tension,
right.
Some there, far more so than in print. But television, because it is this kind of simulation of what it's like to be with another person, seems to affect us, and our brains react more strongly than we do to audio only or print.
You know, I'm thinking about movies. I mean, movies use close-up all the time, and in many ways, you know, it allows you to see so closely what a character is feeling or even thinking.
Exactly. And it's funny you mention that, because I was actually a film major as an undergraduate. And so I made films, and they taught us that if you want emotional intensity, you go in for the close-up. And so when I saw the same phenomenon going on with political television, I thought, well, how does that affect the way we respond to these human beings? Are we, you know, reacting more emotionally, more intensely to them now?
Chris, I'm sorry we couldn't get your call on the air, but you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We have a lot of emails here I want to read, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We have an email from Ramona. I'm a liberal, but I'm interested in understanding conservative viewpoints. However, I can't get anywhere near the shout shows, aside from having an extremely unpleasant visceral reaction. Very little, if any, useful information results from the agitation and time lost. I mean, that's the other thing, which is, what are people actually fighting about?
Right. Well, and I think for someone like this person, she clearly wants to know about the other side. She wants to understand it. She doesn't want to demonize them. She actually wants a sense of the rationales behind their views. I'd say read. We know that in the abstract form, when we read these arguments, we're able to process them in a different way, not nearly as emotionally, and we don't have that kind of knee-jerk reaction that makes us just want to wring their necks. So if you want the content, the arguments, and so forth, that's easier to process that way. We're drawn into the human drama when we watch it on television.
What about people that say very nasty things but use a very quiet, measured voice? I don't have a ready example at my fingertips, but there are people say things you go, what? But they're not yelling and screaming. They're saying outrageous things.
They're biting somehow. Yeah, it's a biting comment. Well, it's interesting. I had the same problem in finding many examples of that, because what tends to happen, like, we originally wanted to do an experiment where one person was uncivil and the other stayed civil. And part of it is that, you know, in human interaction, we feed off of one another. So when one person says something nasty, even if in a calm voice, the other person reacts, and then that builds, and so on and so forth. So when we had versions of our political exchanges that were unbalanced in that right. way, our viewers said they were unrealistic.
This just doesn't
right.
happen in real
yeah,
life.
In real life, we respond to one another, and we feed off of one another's intensity. And so we ended up not running that version, so it's an open question.
And you did run experiments, which is interesting, to set up scenarios with actors, and then you had people watching.
Right. We wanted to create a situation where we had exactly the same content in different civil and uncivil versions, where the politicians had the same viewpoints in a civil and uncivil version. So rather than taking things off the air where all of those things would vary simultaneously, I actually hired actors, one of whom was a failed congressional candidate in the state of California, to portray these politicians. There was a host to the program, as there usually is, and it was done in a set for a professional talk show. What we were able to say from that kind of highly controlled experimental situation is, look at how recall is different for the very same information in the civil versus the uncivil condition. We are able
recall
to
– Recall of the viewer.
Right, right. What did the viewer remember about which politician stood where? And the fact is, they do remember a lot about who stood where when it's uncivil. They are rapt. They pay attention in a way that they tend to get bored when they're, you know, just going back and forth and very measured and calm and – very polite. So, you know, violating norms, we all know that people who violate norms draw attention to themselves. So that works on television too. Big surprise. But, you know, ultimately, I think it is a problem when we come away thinking that these people aren't even the same species we are. They don't obey the same rules of behavior that we do. They are human. They are normal people. However, they are doing political theater for purposes of gaining audiences. And in this country, we don't make it easy for politicians. We don't give them free air time. We don't have opportunities for them to talk to the American public in their own words, you know, outside of 30-second ads and so forth. So, or stage debates where they have to combat someone else. And I personally think that would be terrific because I think, you know, if a politician were an American Idol candidate and had their 10 minutes to talk about whatever they wanted directly to the American public, uninterrupted, without, you know, someone screaming at them and so forth, people probably would see them in a better light.
Do you think this will ever happen?
Oh, I can be an optimist.
Of which
yeah.
you dream?
I don't know, but I am an optimist.
Let me read a couple of more email comments. This is from Nate. He says, the in-your-face that is used in political TV in a way to keep people out of the political conversation and to keep the topics the same rather than to allow new topics to enter the conversation. That's a question. I think what he's saying is that these conversations are not just conflict laden, but they're so controlled that we don't really walk away from them knowing something or learning something.
Yeah, I think it depends on the context. I wouldn't say that's true of all programs. There are some where certainly I learn a great deal. But part of what's happened is I think our standards are lower because we have lots and lots of airspace to fill these days. And people used to complain a lot about how the range of viewpoints represented on television was very narrow, very mainstream. Now that we have a lot more airtime, we actually get some pretty wild viewpoints out there that didn't used to when we only had a, you know, evening news program.
That's right.
Yeah. They were never heard. Now they're heard. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is kind of a matter of opinion because some people feel like, well, they are too far out. They shouldn't be given time because it legitimizes those viewpoints. But I think it's true that we hear a wider range of viewpoints than we used to.
And it seems the person who says the most outrageous thing gets the most attention.
Unfortunately,
right?
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
I was sort of curious about something you said very early in the show, which is, and it's true, TV sets have gotten gigantic.
They have.
So if you've got the close-up, it's not just that they're, you know, they're like 6 feet wide
right.
close-up.
Yeah.
Does that intensify the experience?
Yes, absolutely. In labs, we've seen that not only does it matter how big the TV is, it matters how close you sit to it. Because if you think about your field of vision, it changes based on how close to the screen you are. TV screens have gotten much bigger. Our living rooms have not. So we're sitting really close to really big screens. And yes, we find that emotional reactions intensify from that. And it's also another technological change worth noting is high definition. All the kinds of things that lead us to process those images as if they were real people and to apply the rules for face-to-face behavior to people on television screens are encouraged by this kind of reality-like appearance. And, you know, people who think, oh, I know, it's just television, it's just theater, we do, and yet think about, you know, if something, a car comes toward you on a television screen, you pull back. Now, you know that's stupid because the car isn't going to hit you. It's a TV. And by the same token, you know that politician isn't going to jump out of the TV into your lap and get mad at you. But our brains have not really fundamentally adapted to highly representative technology because these are people walking around looking like real live people, and we respond to them as if they are.
On that note, Diana Mutz, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And she's the Samuel A. Stauffer Professor of Political Science and Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where she serves as Director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics, and again, our guest on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. And go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. I should add her new book is called In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.